Right. Good morning, everyone. Just a very brief overview of what I do today, why I don't think it's enough, and maybe a couple of ideas as to how we could take things forward. I'd like to just start with a quick quote from a recent game. And I think we would agree we would never hear this from any politician who wanted to keep their job. But this was Lucy just a few weeks ago, and she'd had a torrid time. The press had been lambasting her, the president was blaming everything on her, he'd just gone rogue, he was running around, his aides didn't know what he was going to get up to, and I thought, we'll just run with that. Left them to it, and she came to me just before lunch, she said, can I speak to everyone? It was completely unprompted, and this is what she came out with. And we have a photo. There is a happy ending to this one because she was getting quite stressed about this. This is the afternoon when the first meeting was taking place with the district leaders from the town of Lamport. Actually, that is Lucy. She's not actually doing a great deal at that point in time. She's already delegated by now. She's learned to do this. This is her aide, who was a bit fierce. She had this fluffy pencil that she would wave at people if they weren't doing what they should be doing. And Lucy had already realised what she was good at, what other people were good at. And it turned out, well, even here we have the president, who was only 10, to be fair. He was a changed man in the afternoon. I put this down to the fact that he'd said he was going out to play football with his mates, and Lucy insisted he was not going out to play football, and she took him round on a tour of the city during the lunch break. In the afternoon, he was on task and on message. So, quickly about me, I am a child of the 70s, so I was introduced through some greats of the wargaming scene. Obviously, you've heard of none of these. But first of all, my dad, Airfix Napoleonics is the first wargame I recall, by candlelight. Not atmospheric, it was the 70s, there was a power cut. Shortly after that, he took me to his school wargames club on a Saturday. Acres of Airfix tanks, things like that. I was quite upset because one of the bigger boys said my diecast Spitfire was the wrong scale and I couldn't play. But despite that, Dave Smith was my primary head teacher who would give his car keys on a Friday lunchtime and let us get his 50mm Napoleonics out and refight Waterloo every Friday afternoon, as long as you'd done all your work. And then he took me to my first war game show, which was mind-blowing. A group of us went there and we were like, adults do this? Jenny Darley, no interest in wargaming, very little interest, I should say, in military history. But at secondary school, she was a big believer in supporting students with some initiative, and who pestered her. So she spent every Friday after school in an unheated shed with a cup of tea for a couple of hours whilst we pushed around spray-painted 6mm figures, because they were cheap. And finally, Robin Thompson was a geographer at my sixth form. Her interest was in games without dice that involved lots of talking, which was, again, a real change there. His classroom, even though geography was full of campaign maps, and his stock cupboard was full of figures and board games, anything you could want would be in Robin's cupboard. He's retired to be a farmer in Poland. Interesting man. However, all of that work that was taking place, and then I learned from that, and I ran my own war games club. I took trips. We went to air shows. It was fantastic. But it never really changed wargaming, because we know the demographics. Every group I belonged to, every group I ran was all boys. And it didn't really change education because it was all extracurricular. And it was all reliant on very enthusiastic teachers giving up their own time. But after time, when I'd gone back into secondary education, the head of history came to me and said, you know, you've been running that history club. Could you do something for a history topic that we've got coming? And I said, brilliant, what is it? She said, it's 1940. And I was thinking, right, how could we do something that teaches them how things turned out in 1940, maybe why we didn't get invaded. So I was racking my brains, and I remembered something I'd read in a war games magazine about 20 years before called Matrix Games. And it was very, and I couldn't be bothered trawling through them, so I did a bit of Googling, and I found myself on some bloke's website. Very eclectic stuff on there, which led me to Mega Game Makers. And within a few weeks, I was playing a game in Leeds. I was a Canadian operations officer, busy writing orders, giving them to an umpire, no dice were involved. I made sure my senior commander was kept busy elsewhere. And even though, allegedly, no one wins Mega Games, the Canadians did take on that day. Following on from that, I got more heavily involved in Mega Game Makers. I was running games, or helping to run games, in the south and up north. And at the same time, I was getting increasingly frustrated at work, so I decided to take another break from teaching. And two things that occupied my time were Pennine Maker Games and Story Living Games. Pennine Maker Games, I'll be honest, the impetus for setting up Pennine was based on a sort of a light bulb moment at a game in London when Jim had 300 people playing a game of Alien Invasion and came out onto the stage at the end of it. I got a spontaneous round of applause and just said, thank you for playing my game. And I thought, I want a piece of that. Not Jim, but that sense of accomplishment, that sense of achievement. But I did realise I'd need other people to help me do it. So Jerry's over there and has helped me run several games. In fact, there's Jerry, dressed up as the Fat Controller because he was the trains marshal for this particular game. It's set in the 1930s. I was also looking to try and do some different things as well. I was conscious we were getting lots of board war gamers coming to Mega Games, and if they weren't confident in terms of necessarily negotiating and quite how to play the game, how could we do this? So I'd been to Connections, I'd looked at RCAP, where's Graham? There he is. I like the idea of trackers, but I wanted to make it a little bit more unpredictable. So we can see here that people are spending political capital, they won't find out how effective it is, because the numbers are on the reverse of the counters. So people did have to make some decisions, but it wasn't down to the roll of a dice, so it was quite interesting. I also set up Story Living Games. This is the first game that I ran. It was based on Jim's Crisis in Britannia game of ancient Celts before the Romans. I love her expression there. Oh, I can't believe he's traded wood for sheep. But it was taking some of the mega game ideas, but saying there's only one person who can run this game, and I've got at least 30 in a room. Teachers, funnily enough, even though they say at the start of the day they've got some marking to do, they've got some else to do, will be in there for most of the day just to see what's going on, because they say, oh, I'm just being a bit nosy. They want to know what the kids are doing. And you'll be surprised by the number who will say, oh, we play games like this, or I'd love to play a game like this for adults. So actually showing them how the game works really gets them engaged. I picked this one. Just in terms of some real-life issues, here we have the president of the city there, and this was taken about 30 seconds before she sacked her aide for corruption. She'd noticed that he'd been taking resources, sticking them in his pockets and giving them to his friends' teams. And she went, right, you're sacked. And she was the smallest person in the room. And he went, can she do that? And I went, she is the president. And he went, all right. And toddle off back to his district. So then what I started moving and developing more were crisis type games rather than just historical games. This was based on a little bit of Aftershock, a little bit of Jim's Urban Nightmare, and mixing various bits and pieces in here. That's the UN/presence board. This is a district board. There are usually eight districts that need fixing, and there are various resources because I don't know why I was surprised, but they love trading things and making deals. The number of stickers, plastic monsters that I have confiscated over the years, I should have known this. I have got examples of these boards you can have a look at afterwards. That's the summer school quite recently. We noticed the girls are the ones actually who are getting the boards out and making lists of what needs to be done, whilst the boys are going, can we have some steel? I don't know. What I've also quite enjoyed recently is finding some games that work with the children and adults as well. So here we have a four-girl RAF team playing Finest Hour. This was the version where the boards are split up and different teams are on different tables. We played it on Tuesday, Connections. As of Tuesday, I'm pleased to report that at least the under-16s have a 100% record against the Nazis. I was thinking, I'm sure the Germans can't win. Oh, they can. And really, thinking in terms of then how do we try and get it into the curriculum, what are schools looking for? They talk about, they want to develop empathy. One of the boys, the first time I ran the crisis game, the Shattered City, he was in charge of the business district, and he came to me and said, sir, can I go and sit with the people in the slums? And I said, well, you can. I said, why do you want to? He said, well, they haven't got many resources. I said, well, that's a really good spot. Yeah, they didn't have as much as everyone else to start with. He said, well, I want to go and sit with them. I said, well, you don't need to sit with them. You can give them some. He said, no. He said, I've been watching and they don't know what to do. So they need someone to go and show them. And I thought, well, he spotted that and actually I failed to do that. Resilience, dying, was a bit of a concern for me. I'm not sure whether it's computer games to do this one, but when we did the Celts game, there was it was the Bag of Fate, and it was just full of coloured beads, and you could pull out as many beads as you wanted. Cattle raiding, showing off in your chariot, boar hunting, whatever. And you would see them going in, as if you pulled out three red ones, you were dead. And they quickly got into the mindset that I'm a Celt, I will die, the main thing is I die well, and when I die, my name goes on the wall. And they were fine with that. So I thought, yeah, we want to encourage that. Or the fact that this turn has finished, or a bit like Lucy at the start, okay, this morning's not gone well, but we will sort it in the afternoon. Growth mindset and British values are very big in British schools at the moment. It's well worth having a look at those, but it's very much around a positive I can attitude, democracy, rule of law. You can see the links there. And for those in the States, what is now the Quaglia Institute, used to be the Global Institute of Student Aspirations, identified a pathway to develop aspirations in young people. Starting with belonging, heroes. If you can't see how games can give a sense of accomplishment, fun and excitement, spirit of adventure, leadership and responsibility, then we shouldn't be here, really. I am targeting, at the moment, younger. So Mario's targeting 14 and upwards. The youngest I've had playing has been 8. I was in a primary school fairly recently, talking to the head teacher about how to do something for Key Stage 1, so that's from about 6 upwards. Because I really want to get down and work with the younger groups as much as possible. Why? We want to give them sorry, can you just have some water, please? We want to give them experiences that they will come back to. They might not stay in wargaming or gaming full stop, but we want them to see it maybe in the future and go, I remember doing that, that was a great time. The sooner we offer those opportunities, the sooner they're embedded and imprinted. Wargaming is not the most diverse group in society, we know this. But in a classroom, you have got that broad cross-section. And they have to be there in this country. It's a legal requirement, so let's make the most of it. It's not self-selected, you get all sorts in there, and very different perspectives. And to be honest, you might think I've cherry-picked photos with girls taking charge, taking leadership roles. To be honest, that just happens at this age. And what you notice is they start to get older, because I've talked from right down there up to the older groups as well, is that as they start to get older, the girls tend to sink back a bit more and let the boys start taking the leading roles. And I think it's really important we start establishing those. It was, I did think about it on Tuesday when I was thinking, that was Wargaming 101. We're thinking about the future of wargaming, but when you looked at who was making the decisions as opposed to who was reporting on the decisions, it didn't feel like a great deal of change at that point in time. It might change the next few years, but I think we really need to be thinking, what can we think about for 10 years in the future? And obviously, if you walk in after the teacher has said, we're doing something different today and we're not doing normal lessons, you are the best person ever. And you will find no greater advocates of wargaming than these. I did mention the blue bag approach and man in the van. The blue bag approach was something that was pioneered by the Youth Sport Trust, who I ended up working for in my first time out of teaching. And it was to try and address a lack of focus and status for PE in primary schools. Every school was offered a big blue bag, as the name suggests, of sports equipment. But the deal was you only got the bag, or you were only allowed to unzip the bag, and access the cards that came with it, unless you provided an instructor, a trainer, to come in and spend 4 hours with your staff focusing on PE. The cards were very, very basic. It was there to reassure teachers that you don't have to be able to coach David Beckham to teach PE to primary school children. You need to teach them to run, to jump, to throw, to transfer some skills and to enjoy it. And it also meant, because the teachers were all coming together, they were sharing their experiences, and it made a real impact. It raised the profile of PE. It was partly responsible, I think, for the establishment of school sports partnerships in this country. We had secondaries working with primaries, working with community sports clubs, working with local authorities, governing bodies. There were talent pathways being identified. Michael Gove cancelled it almost as one of his first actions as education secretary. I'm not saying it was about its flaws, but that was somewhat short-sighted, given all the announcements about the Olympic legacy at the same time. As a result of that, there was some belated funding went out, and this is where you end up with the man in the van. I'm not talking about a child catcher. by the way, I do love this girl. Everyone else is sort of stood there in their line. I'm having my photo taken. But the man in the van approaches now. A lot of schools get some funding. It's even called sport premium. It's not physical education. And what that means is that a lot of them say, brilliant, we can use that. When our teachers should be doing their marking and things like that, we'll get someone in to do some sport with them. And because the teachers aren't too fussed about doing it, or they don't feel confident. So someone comes in who's usually, well, they're not a qualified teacher. They focus on sport, they're not teaching physical education, they're not given a broad curriculum, and it's seen as an add-on. And I did warn this to a number of PE teachers who are advocating various things like this. I said, you're devaluing your subject, because what you're seeing is, this is fun, a lot of the time the kids will enjoy it, but it's not education. And what you're doing is you're moving it aside. So, in terms of thinking about some recommendations, one, thinking about the education context. There are time pressures, there are financial pressures. The finest hour game came about because a school had booked me, it was the assistant head had booked me, and then when it came to deciding when I was going in, the head of year said, oh, actually, we've got three classes. You can't do three classes in one day, can't you? I was like, well, I usually spend a whole day with a class, but then I thought other schools will be in that situation, so it's worthwhile trying this, and as it turned out, it was a happy coincidence. Think about education outcomes and making sure it's linked to the curriculum, what they actually want to do. The disaster game came about because schools were studying natural disasters and they wanted to look at it. You need to train, empower teachers. I'm not saying there's a massive crossover between wargaming and teachers, but certainly there is, I think, between board gaming. And there's a lot of interest there. And I think if you can try and make it look a bit like a board game and get them to see how they can tie it in. So what I'm going to look at, quite a few people have asked me about my games and can they buy the games. And I don't want to just give them the game without talking about what goes behind it, or just even just sell them the game. So I'm going to look at putting together maybe a weekend with some teachers who are board gamers to see what we can come up with in terms of those. And the last one there is language. Mara mentioned it, the use of war and games. And I know it's very dear to some people using war games. And I'm not saying we shouldn't call them war games in other contexts. But particularly in the education context I'm talking about, even if we had thousands of head teachers signed up to wargaming and they were sneaking into conventions without us knowing about it, or having secret wargame speakeasies for female teachers, even if that happened, I don't think you would still want to use the word wargames, because you get things like this. And this was a lesson on the First World War. It wasn't an official lesson. It was on the Times Ed site for teachers to download. It was all about trying to challenge myths that British generals tried nothing new in the war. It was based on Dragon's Den to make it relevant to the students, and it was getting them to identify why certain weapons were used, why they were more effective, why generals would want to use them. And because of one teacher complaining and letting the press know about this, and if it's not a politician with more time than you to debate the point, it's going to be parents. Who don't necessarily understand what's been achieved there. So if we can find anything, you know, I know, it's wargaming. But if we're going into the schools, if we could try and find a different approach to it, that would be brilliant. Thank you. Oh, sorry. I was going to finish on a high note. That's the Regni. Just before they went to meet their fate at the hands of the Romans. But I loved their enthusiasm. Thank you very much.